It's a joy to greet you
in the name of the Lord. This is a very special week in the life of this church. It's hard to believe, but we moved to Wheaton 10 years ago. It's a whole decade. And one of the things that attracted us to College Church was the emphasis on missions. When Ellen and I graduated from Bible Institute, an accredited school run by our denomination, when we graduated in another millennium, we sensed the Lord was calling us to foreign missionary service. And in 1967, we were introduced at the National Convention of the Mennonite Brethren in Canada, introduced as pre-candidate candidates to the convention. They said, go and get a little more education, and then when you're done, we'll send you out. Well, we went and got a little more education, and here we are. The rest is history. I suppose we are foreign missionaries. You have to be careful how you say that. We are not native here. It is a cross-cultural experience. But, we'll send you back. Hey, shortly after we moved across the border in 1983, I was teaching at another institution. It would never happen here. And somebody asked me, before the class started, a loaded question that related to some politics in this country. Well, when the term papers came in at the end of the semester, one of the guys, at the end of his term paper, he wrote at the bottom of his paper, Dr. Block, if you don't like the way we do things around here, you have three options. One, go back where you came from. Two, get with the program. Or three, keep your mouth shut. I showed it to my dean. He was not impressed. So I have no idea what happened to the guy. But in any case, that it was cross-cultural. We've been here. Pardon me? I have. I work in the Old Testament, so grace reigns, A+. I have no idea what I gave. What the question is, what grade did you give him? I don't know. But in any case, so all this to say that we love the missions emphasis in this church. And actually, we love the support we have had from this church. In April, some of you are aware that we are going to Bologna, Italy, to be with Mark Brucato for 4 or 5 days at his church. This is not working very well. And to give a couple of lectures at the university on the Torah, very fascinating thing. And then all day Saturday we'll be in his church teaching. Pray that we would be a blessing. That's what this is about, isn't it? Being a blessing to others. But that trip is funded by FTT. So thank you very, very much. And then in June, some of you know Franklin Wang, who's part of our class when he is available. He is from Beijing. We are going to Beijing, and I will spend a week with him in Beijing among his people. That will be fabulous. And then I will fly to Hong Kong and spend a week in Hong Kong teaching 50 or 60 leaders of house churches in mainland China on the book of Ezekiel. That will be interesting. And then come September, we are scheduled to go to Samara, Russia for a week of teaching. So You know, we had this sense of call when we graduated, but the interesting thing is now at the end, not of life, 40 years of teaching, all of these doors are opening up all over the place, and the Lord is blessing us so richly with these opportunities, and I pray that we would have good energy, good health, whatever else is needed for these kinds of trips. But the world has been on our hearts from the beginning, and at this stage in life, it's happening, and we just... And people ask, well, how do you do this? Well, there's only one spiritual gift I claim, and that is sleep. Which is rather important if you travel a lot, as some of you know. And so it's a great blessing that in all of these travels, by the grace of God, we tend to adjust rather quickly. Coming home is always worse because you're relaxed. It has nothing to do with direction. It's all psychological. Whether I'm going east or west, when you land there, you're pumped, the adrenaline's going, you're on. You've got to be going. You come home and you feel sorry for yourself. You can't sleep. You get up and you mess with your computer a little bit, take care of some... Nah, it's all psychological. But God in his mercy has opened up, you know, all of this. We have been so, so blessed. And we are so grateful for the interest of this church in missions and personally for the interest of y'all in the kinds of things the Lord has been putting on our hearts. Pray that we would all continue to be faithful to whatever God asks of us. Well, I am determined to finish our topic on marriage and divorce today. It is an awkward topic to talk about because it is so common. I am sure there isn't a person here who doesn't have if it hasn't been our experience, and I know for some of us that is the case, but there's probably not a person here who doesn't have a sibling or a very close friend or relative for whom that, and we know what happens. The pain and the grief in all of that. And so it is important for us to reflect biblically on this. I was encouraged as we were driving into church this morning when we come for the 8 o'clock service. We always prepare by listening to Dr. Ryken. He's always on at 8:30, and this morning he was on this topic, and I was encouraged to hear him speak on these matters. We ended last week, I think, by looking at a couple of narrative texts, ending with Ezra on the matter of divorce in the First Testament, and I think we just got to Malachi chapter 2, and we need to settle here in Malachi chapter 2 for a while and reflect on what this text may have to say to us. Malachi chapter 2, the whole book of Malachi, incidentally, isn't about giving. The only time we ever hear a sermon on Malachi is when our budget's short. And then we appeal to, bring all the tithes into the storehouse and see if I won't bless you if you give. And so our appeals are, give that you may get. And we don't realize how Canaanite that is. It is Canaanite. That's fertility religion. But in any case, the book of Malachi is not about giving. The book of Malachi is about, there is no fear of God in this place. You have expressions for that. You honor your governor, you honor your father, but where's my honor? Try giving to your governor what you are giving to me. And because there is no fear of God, people are bored with worship. They don't keep their vows. The priests are all out of whack. They used to be leading people in paths of righteousness, but now they're leading people in evil. People are stingy with their giving. People don't care for the poor and the marginalized. This is all a consequence of there is no fear of God in this place. That's the issue. So when we preach Malachi, we should not be preaching tithing. That's not the problem. That's only a symptom. It is the fear of God. And in the absence of the fear of God, unfortunately, it hits us right at home. And our text is about that. There is no fear of God in this. Malachi 2, 10 to 16. We have in this text two treacheries. And of course, the word treachery, I think, appears 6 or 7 times in this whole passage. Treachery is a word that's used of those who are in a political alliance and who violate the terms of the alliance. It's interesting, towards the end of our text, there will be this word covenant. It means breaking covenant, being disloyal to the vows that we have made. So the first treachery, Malachi 2, 10 to 16. Have we not all one Father? Has not one God created us? Why then are we faithless to one another, profaning the covenant of our fathers? And of course, that's the gracious covenant that God has made with Israel. Now we ask, how are they profaning, desecrating that covenant? Judah has been, there's that word, treacherous, beged. You not know some Hebrew, beged. Judah has been guilty of beged, and an abomination has been committed in Israel and in Jerusalem, for Judah has profaned the sanctuary of Yahweh, the Lord, which he loves. And of course, you understand what that means. To whom he is covenantally committed, and I think at this point, the sanctuary of the Lord doesn't necessarily mean the box, the building. It is the whole holy business, and has married the daughter of a foreign god. I think this is where we stopped last week. Just as the Israelites are called sons and daughters of their God, so other people are called sons and daughters of their gods. This is what happens when you've got, what shall we say, cross-cultural marriage. But of course, it's not just cross-cultural in that innocent sense. It is cross-spiritual. People who represent two different kingdoms. They are sons and daughters of a foreign god because they're devoted to those gods the way the Israelites are supposed to be devoted. This is what happened. That's the first treachery. You commit treachery against the Lord with this kind of marriage, and you commit treachery against the rest of the community. We all have a vested interest in one another's marriages. We do. It is not just an individual thing. So that whom you marry is not just your business. It is your family's business, and it is the community of faith's business. And then he says, may the Lord cut off from the tents of Jacob any descendant of the man who does this, who brings an offering to the Lord of hosts. And so now you understand. We're going to do this, and then we'll keep on playing the games. I should have brought the diagram I have somewhere. Right? We have Cain's theology of worship, as opposed to Abel's. Why did God not accept Cain's offering, but he accepted Abel's? Well, there are those who will tell us it's because Abel's involved blood and you're supposed to bring blood. The only problem with that interpretation is probably not the only problem. The kind of offering Cain brought was a legitimate kind of offering. In fact, the same word is used for both, mincha. This is a tribute gift to God. Both of them are bringing them. And you bring what you raise. That's it. Grain offerings are good from the get-go. There's nothing wrong with a grain offering. You bring what God blesses you with. But the interesting thing is then when it says, when it talks about God's response, it's very intentional in the text. It may not be in your English translation, but it's very clear in the English. God looked upon Abel and accepted his offering. God looked upon Cain and rejected it. You see the difference? We have a tendency to think that God looks at us through our worship. The games we play on Sunday. No, it's the opposite. God looks at the games we play on Sunday through the hearts that we demonstrate in everyday life. And so you have it here. May the Lord cut up. That is strong. And of course, the point is, even in our marriage ceremonies, we say we are gathered today in the presence of these witnesses and in the presence of God. The moment we say that, we are invoking God as a guarantor of our fidelity. And in effect, releasing him to visit us with a curse if we're unfaithful. Changes things, doesn't it? This is not just civil. It is very spiritual. That's the first treachery. The second treachery. It's a different thing. Here's a second thing you do. You cover the Lord's altars with tears, with weeping and groaning because he no longer regards the offering or accepts it with favor from your hand. Why does God accept our worship? It's interesting. There's a text in Peter. We do read the New Testament, don't we? Where he says, that your prayers be not hindered. Watch how you treat your wife, that your prayers be not hindered. There's a link between the response of God. He no regards the offering and accepts it with favor. And you say, why not? Why doesn't God hear my prayers? Why doesn't he accept my offering? Why does nothing get beyond the ceiling? Because the Lord was a witness between you and the wife of your youth, to whom you have been treacherous. Faithless, though she is your companion and your wife by covenant. Oh, now it makes sense why he uses this word. Almost how many decades ago we said, till death do us part, through thick and through thin, good or ill, whatever, we signed on. We didn't sign on conditionally, well, if you behave yourself, I'll be faithful, or whatever else, or if all goes well. No, by covenant. Did he not make one with a portion? The Hebrew gets very, very difficult. We don't need to bog down in it. But did he not make them one? Who's he? Presumably God. Again, we operate on the assumption, as God's people, that God binds us. And what was the one God seeking? Godly offspring. So guard yourselves in your spirit and let none of you be treacherous to the wife of your youth. And of course, you know, we wonder about, again, the patricentrism of this thing. Notice where the emphasis is. Guys, watch yourselves. And of course, in a patricentric world, if you want the power, you also have to take the responsibility. And so he lays it on. It's like our text in Deuteronomy 24. For the man who does not love, we've translated does not love. There's that word again. Sane, hate, as opposed to love. for a man who withdraws his covenant commitment from his wife and sends her out, shalach, that word was used in Deuteronomy as well, says and divorces her, says the Lord, the God of Israel covers his garment with violence, says the Lord of hosts. So guard yourselves in your spirit. Don't be treacherous. And of course, isn't this what Jesus is getting at? It doesn't start in the external acts. Watch your inside, which is why the Shema, we keep coming back, Deuteronomy's ringing in his ears. Shema Israel, Yahweh Eloheinu, Yahweh Echad. Hear, O Israel, our God is the Lord, only the Lord. And then, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, means inner being, with all your person, and with all your stuff. Notice where it starts. The inside. The inside. Guard. This is why Paul keeps telling Timothy, take heed to yourself and to your doctrine. Here, take, watch your heart. Watch the inside. Dispositions, thoughts, everything. It's not just heart. It's heart and mind. And this is your spirit, your disposition. Well, actually, there is, we leave it, we'll leave it there. This is Malachi's. This is the strongest text in all of, the closest you come in all of Scripture, all of the Old Testament, to a legislation on marriage and divorce. Remember, our Deuteronomy text is not legislation on divorce. It's legislation on remarriage. And so it assumes divorce is happening. It doesn't legitimize it or authorize it, but it seeks to govern it so that in the context where we men have a propensity to abuse our wives anyhow, we don't abuse them further. Well, here, this is a strong word. Some of you have the translation that's different at the beginning of this last paragraph, for the man who does not love his wife. Your translation has, for God hates divorce. It's a very different translation. It's a very different. The problem is we have a verb form that doesn't have a subject. And you have to ask yourself, who is the subject of this? And recent work on this, Holman's Christian Standard Bible has it right now this way. I think the new NIV has it this way. And this is, and the ESV, I think, actually does it this way, something like this as well. So, the tradition has, for God hates divorce. He does, we know that. But we don't need a proof text to know that. So here it's, for the man who hates and divorces. That's it. Who rejects his wife. And this echoes Deuteronomy 4. That's marriage and divorce at the human level. It's interesting how important, how significant this motif is at the theological level. And there are people who stumble theologically because God divorces Israel. Well, let's look at that. Isaiah 50, thus says the Lord, where is your mother's certificate of divorce with which I divorce her? Or which of my creditors is it to whom I have sold you? Look, for your iniquities you were sold, and for your transgression your mother was divorced. And, of course, your mother now would be Jerusalem, or the land of Israel, and the children are the inhabitants. Or Jeremiah 3:1. If a man divorces his wife and she goes from him and becomes another man's wife, oh, we've heard that. That is a clear echo of Deuteronomy 24. Jeremiah No prophet in the Old Testament has his devotions in Deuteronomy as much as Jeremiah. There are echoes all over the place. Well, here we have it. And he becomes another man's wife. Will he return to her? Would not that land be greatly polluted? You have played the whore with many lovers, and would you return to me? The declaration of the Lord. Well, this is simply asking the question, will you come back to me? The Lord is asking. But of course, the most dramatic example of marriage and divorce is the book of Hosea. Let's go there. I think we need to spend a little time in Hosea here. And of course, I am so glad that I'm not in Hosea's shoes. This is tough. The book of Hosea, when the Lord first spoke through Hosea, the Lord said to Hosea, go, take yourself a wife of harlotry, a harlotress woman, and have children from this harlotress woman, for the land commits flagrant harlotry, forsaking the Lord. Prophets had a tough lot, didn't they? A prophet like Jeremiah is forbidden from ever marrying for the sake of the message. A prophet like Ezekiel marries, but then in chapter 24, the Lord comes and says, Ezekiel, you're about to lose your wife, and in the morning she was gone for the sake of the message. And here you've got Hosea. So he went and he took Gomer, the daughter of Divlaim. I got lots of... In the Old Testament, priests were forbidden by law from marrying divorcees. But there is no law that does this one. So, but in any case, he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Divlaim. She conceived and bore him sons and named him Jezreel. So they got two kids. One is named Jezreel, for I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. You can't even name your own kids. Then she conceived again and gave birth to a daughter, and the Lord said to him, name her Lo-Ruhamah. Now, Ruhamah is a very nice name, compassion. But Lo-Ruhamah means no compassion. It's over. For I will no longer have compassion on the house of Israel, and that I would ever forgive them. But I will have compassion on the house of Judah. So now we're to Hosea is a prophet to the northern kingdom. I'm hanging in there with Judah. But the northern kingdom's done. When she had waned Lo-Ruhamah, she conceived and gave birth. And the Lord said, name him Lo-Ami. For you are not my people and I am not your God. You've heard that before. That's a takeoff on the marriage formula. I will be your God and you will be my people. And now it's done. I am not your people. Lo-Ami means not my people. And I am not your God. It's a tough one. And so the message comes to Hosea. But then in chapter 3. The rest of chapter 1 and chapter 2 is all about message now. God's word to a rebellious people that has been harlotrous, by which he means going after other gods. That's what the metaphor means. Chapter 3, then the Lord said to me, go again, love a woman who is loved by her husband, yet an adulteress, even as the Lord loves the sons of Israel, though they turn to other gods and they love their raisin cakes. So I bought her for myself for 15 shekels of silver and a homer and a half of barley. And I said to her, you will stay with me for many days. You'll not play the harlot anymore, nor shall you have a man, for I will also be toward you. For the sons of Israel will remain for many days without king or prince, without sacrifice or sacred pillar, without ephod or household. Afterwards, the sons of Israel will return and seek the Lord their God and David their king, and they'll come trembling to the Lord and his goodness in the last days. What's going on here? He divorces his wife, and then he discovers her there on the auction block among all the slaves. She's being sold as a slave. This is what's happened to her. It's It's beyond the prodigal son. The guy realized he's eating with the pigs. And he buys her back and makes her his wife again. Twice bought. Twice liberated. Twice freed. And of course, the reason I bring this one up, because it looks like it is violating the principle of Deuteronomy 24. Didn't God say, if you divorce your wife and then she becomes another person's husband, you cannot have her back? Isn't that exactly what we have here? Well, it's not quite that simple. If you do a comparison between these two, you will notice that the disposition of the husband to the marriage in the two is very different. In the first one, Deuteronomy 24, despite having agreed to the marriage, when the time came to consummate it, he changed his mind. With God, having promised to the ancestors to enter into covenant relationship with Israel, the Lord sealed that covenant at Sinai. He didn't change his mind. The condition of the wife. In the first, she's physically flawed but morally innocent. By my interpretation, in this case, she's physically fine but morally flawed. The issues are quite different. How about the disposition of the husband to the wife here? In the first one, totally lacking in grace. She doesn't find grace in the eyes of her husband. In this one, lavish in his outpouring of grace before and after the marriage. In fact, for 500 years, he's been pouring out his grace. And she spits in his face. The cause of the divorce in the first one, the husband's hardness of heart. In this case, the wife's infidelity and adulterous conduct. The time of the divorce, in the first one, apparently before it was consummated. In this one, centuries after the marriage was sealed. The sequel, remarriage to another man in that case here. No remarriage, actually. I mean, she's been playing, messing around. No remarriage. She's reduced to the status of a slave on the auction block, but then rescued by her husband. Possibility of remarriage. Remarriage to the original husband denied. Remarriage to the original husband confirmed. So the pictures all the way through are quite different in this one. And the other thing to recognize here is that this is a theological metaphor. God is he's telling a story using ordinary experiences in everyday life to highlight his grace. And of course, this is why in my books, the book of Hosea is probably perverse. That's not pervert as one word. Perverse is more gracious than any other book in the Old Testament. And it ends, of course, with chapter 11, which is a fabulous chapter on the amazing love of God, which wins out over his justice and his holiness. I am God and not man. That's why I will visit you with grace. It is a story of grace, so don't forget that. One more, Matthew 19:7. We talked about this earlier. The Pharisees came up to Jesus and tested him by asking, is it lawful to divorce one's wife for any cause? He answered, haven't you read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female and said, therefore a man shall leave father and mother and hold fast his wife. They two become one flesh. So they're joined together, two, but not, no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, don't mess with. You see this? Let no one rip apart. It's a virtual woe to anybody who messes with another person's marriage. And they said to him, well, why then did Moses command one to give a certificate of divorce, send her away? Well, yes, he commanded to give a certificate of divorce, but he did not command to divorce. And you want the answer to the question?
If I had been Jesus, I said, because those men were just like you. They're jerks. They mistreat their wives. That's why. He said, because of your hardness of heart, Moses allows you. He didn't stop you from divorcing. But that doesn't mean that that's at all right, at all acceptable. No, it means we have to regulate. You're going to do it. Please, don't abuse again. And that becomes the issue here. Paul has a few things to say about marriage and divorce, so I'd say to those who aren't married and widows, it's better to stay unmarried just as I am. If they can't control themselves, they should go ahead and marry. It's better to marry than to burn. But as for those who are married, I have a command that comes from me, not from the Lord. I love it when Paul does that. I don't have direct revelation on this. It doesn't mean he doesn't have authority. He speaks for God, whether he has revelation or not. A wife must not leave her husband, but if she does leave him, let her remain single or else be reconciled to him, and the husband must not leave the wife. Now, I will speak to the rest of you, though I do not have a direct command from the Lord. This is the second text. If a Christian man has a wife who is not a believer and she is willing to live with him, he must not leave her. And if a Christian woman has a husband who is not a believer and he is willing to continue living with her, she must not. For the Christian wife brings holiness to the marriage, and the Christian husband brings holiness. Otherwise, your children would not be holy. Notice the concern again. How in the world can you expect godly kids if we behave ungodlily? But if a husband or wife who isn't a believer insists on, let them go. In such case, the Christian husband or wife is no longer bound, for God has called you to live in peace. Well, I thought we would finish this. We'll come back next week and talk. Well, you have the notes there. Maybe we don't even, but you probably want to throw some eggs or tomatoes at me next week. We'll give you a chance, a week, to get your basket full of eggs and tomatoes. And we'll talk about, so what of today? What do we do with this? And I think we have to have that conversation for a little bit next week. My time is up, and yours is down. So...